This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. Hi, it's John Williams. We talk business, we talk personal finance, we talk big picture economics in this hour. Today we'll do a little bit, I guess, about all of that in our first segment. Jared Dillian joins us once again. You can find him at jareddillianmoney.com, the best-selling author and financial expert. Has been a frequent guest on the show. He returns again today. Jared, welcome back.
Hey, glad to be here. Today's a big day.
Why do you say that?
We got some inflation numbers. We got PPI today, which came in at 4.2%. Inflation is starting to run hot.
What does that mean to me?
Well, producer prices are generally a leading indicator of consumer prices. So I think what you're already seeing is that you're seeing some price increases at the grocery store and other places, but you might see some broader inflation into the second half of this year. It'll be noticeable.
Will that be a bad thing? I mean, a little bit of inflation is good, right?
Inflation always feels good in the beginning because it feels as if the economy is expanding. It feels as if the economy is booming. The problem is if we're not proactive about fighting it, and then it becomes disruptive. And I would characterize inflation of 6% or higher as disruptive.
So we're at 4.2?
For producer prices, so CPI is still about 2.5%.
CPI, the Consumer Price Index, is that the measure of inflation you're talking about?
Yes.
And so that's well below the threshold you're talking about. I'm just asking for maybe some context here. You sounded like happy about that number a minute ago.
Well, you know, I'm not necessarily happy about it. One of the things we're seeing here is that, you know, I'm here in Myrtle Beach, and Myrtle Beach is a hospitality economy. We have lots of hotels and lots of restaurants. Everywhere you go, you see help wanted signs. There was a billboard on my way into work today advertising $14 an hour for housekeepers. And what's happening is that because of the stimulus and the unemployment benefits, the private sector is being forced to bid against the government for talent. And so wages are coming up. Now, you might say, look, wages have been stagnant for 20 years. So this is a good thing. So higher wages are good. But these higher wages will be passed along to the consumer in form of higher prices. And wage inflation is generally how we get CPI inflation.
So what's the sweet spot then? I mean, where should we be?
I don't know if there is a sweet spot, but this is a big change. You know, this is a big change. We haven't had a real inflationary type environment, in a really long time. And we've been dealing with disinflation for a long time. And, you know, and the implications for interest rates is that they're probably done going down and they're probably going to go higher from here.
I heard mixed signals about the Fed handling interest rates generally. I think we've all been enjoying them, but at some point they're going to have to let inflation rise. Do you agree with that?
Well, the Fed has a couple of mandates. Mandate number one is price stability, and usually that's fighting inflation, although recently they've been taking that to mean fight deflation. And the other mandate is full employment. And that's the mandate that they've been spending most of their time on right now. They haven't had to worry about price stability. So I have a feeling they're going to let inflation run pretty high before they start getting vigilant about it. You know, they changed their inflation target in a very technical way. It's not really worth getting into detail about that. But basically, they're focused on average inflation rather than actual inflation. So they're going to be very slow to react to it.
Ritholtz Wealth Management's Ben Carlson talked about the 20 most important personal finance laws to live by. And I want to run through some of these and see if you agree or disagree with them. We'll get started here, pause, and come back to them. The first point he makes, the first point is avoid credit card debt like the plague. Agree or disagree?
Absolutely agree. And by the way, I've read this list, and I can just tell you up front that I agree with most of what he says. These are some very good rules, but yes, you should avoid credit card debt like the plague. The average interest rate is 19%. You get a lot of money going out the door in terms of interest that's unproductive. You should not carry a balance. And about half of the population carries a balance on their credit cards.
We've been paying that down, I think, during the pandemic, though, haven't we?
Yeah, actually, I don't know the exact number, but we paid down billions in consumer credit. And the weird thing is that, you know, we had a pretty terrible recession and people's credit scores went up during the recession. They went from 703 to 711, which is unheard of.
Your credit score should be 740. Is that a reasonable target? And what about living below your means or within your means? Let's talk about that in just a minute. Jared Dillian, the best-selling author, JaredDillianMoney.com. Jared Dillian's our guest on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We were looking at another wealth manager's advice on what to do with your personal finances. I just wanted to bounce some of them off and see how much you agree. And you do believe building credit is important, Jared, and stay away from credit cards as much as you can. He also said live below your means, not within your means. You agree with that?
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. I would modify that slightly to say live below your means or at your means. As long as you're not living above your means, that's fine. But, you know, I've done this my entire life. I've always lived below my means, and it's allowed me to save at a rate that is disproportionately higher to everyone else and build wealth over time. So, yeah, I believe that to be true.
And some people may say, oh, yeah, easy for you to say. You've got a lot of money. But you also say income is not the same as savings. Talk about that. Or actually, he said that. He said high income doesn't make you rich. Low income doesn't make you poor. It's about what you set aside. That sounds sound, huh?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, and for the record, you know, I haven't always had a lot of money. You know, I started off my career in the Coast Guard. I was a Coast Guard officer. You know, so when I was 27 years old, I was making about $45,000 a year, and I was saving 50% or more of what I made. And what I was able to do with that is save that money and use it as a down payment on a piece of property, and that piece of property returned 60 or 70% within the span of 2 years. So it was because of saving and investing and living below your means that I was able to accomplish that.
This other fella says, I believe in spending money on loads or fees for professional asset management. You can get no-load mutual funds and ETFs. This guy says he thinks you should pay for professional management. What do you say about that?
No, I agree with that. I mean, actually, there's a purpose to sales charges when it comes to mutual funds. And the purpose of those sales charges is to keep you invested in the funds. If you pay a 3% load to get into a mutual fund, you're not going to sell that mutual fund 6 months later. You're going to stay invested for a very long period of time and amortize those sales charges over time.
So if you're not in and out, in and out, in and out, it's not an expensive cost.
Well, it's not only is it not an expensive cost, but you stay invested instead of jumping in and out of funds and, you know, incurring capital gains taxes and not compounding.
He makes this point, automate everything and get the big purchases right, which I think means, okay, if you spend too much on a nice dinner, that's not going to kill you, but make sure you don't buy the wrong car, house, or college education.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, that's basically my core belief when it comes to personal finance. You know, a lot of people believe that it's the accumulation of a million small things that determine whether you have money, such as whether you buy coffee in the morning, turning down the thermostat a couple of degrees. That stuff just does not matter. It does not matter at all. It's the big stuff. It's the house, the car, and the student loans. If you get that right, you don't have to worry about the little stuff.
Do you have a formula for liquid assets? How much cash as a percent, say, of income should I have?
I think that the amount of cash should be 10 to 20% of your net worth.
10 to 20% of your net worth, not of your income, of your net worth.
Yeah.
So if your net worth is $150,000, then you should have 15, 20 grand in the bank somewhere.
Yep, exactly.
Cover your insurable needs. He said you should have life insurance equal to 2 times your income for each dependent. I thought I heard the number once 6 times. I don't know. What's the number on that?
No, I think it's 2 times. 2 times is the right answer. So if you made $70,000 a year and you had a spouse and 2 children, you would need $420,000 in life insurance. That's the right number.
cover your insurance needs. Got it. Always get the match. I'm surprised people would miss that if somebody else is going to match your investments.
You would be surprised. I mean, first of all, there's not everybody takes advantage of a 401k to begin with. You can invest up to $19,500 into a 401k pre-tax, and only about 40% of people take advantage of this. And then in situations where a company will match your contributions and you don't take advantage of that, it's the definition of free money. So if there is a 401k match, you absolutely have to invest.
I don't know what he's talking about here. Choose your friends, your neighborhood, and your spouse wisely. What's that?
Well, I don't know about your friends and your neighborhood, but for sure, who you marry is one of the most important personal finance decisions you will ever make. And you want to marry somebody who shares your values on finance. So if you're very cheap, if you're very frugal, and your spouse likes to spend money, and you just have different ideas on money, you're in for a lifetime of arguments. And it's also the other way around.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you like to spend money and your spouse is cheap, then you're going to be having arguments that way too.
That sounds a mercenary way to chart your love life, doesn't it?
Well, the other thing, which I don't think Ben Carlson mentions, you know, it's one of my key tenets of personal finance, is that married couples should keep their money separate. And that's what my wife and I have done our entire marriage. We've always kept our money separate. And in the 23 years we've been married, we have never once fought about money.
I know another couple that does that, but they both earn money. What do you advise people if only one of them is the breadwinner or the principal breadwinner?
No, it pretty much only works as if both spouses have incomes, for sure.
And would you recommend only marrying somebody who makes a lot of money then?
No, absolutely not.
Although that's not bad if you can manage that. You also do, he says, I'll ask for your comment on this, make more money, which sounds to me like a lifetime of toil. What's your thought about that?
Well, you know, when it comes to your personal finances, if you want to make more money, there's a lot of people do this by cutting expenses. And they cut as many expenses as they can, and they get rid of any possible luxury, large luxuries, small luxuries, and they cut expenses to the bone. But that only does a limited amount of good. If you really want to make more money, you actually have to make more money, and there's things that you can do. You can get a second job, you can ask for a raise, you can change careers, you can start a business, but the amount of money that you can potentially make is unlimited. So I tell people to focus on the revenue side, not the expense side.
It's an interesting way to put it. You want more money? Make more money. Taxes matter. I'm going to do a segment later on with somebody else about taxes, but what's your best advice on managing taxes?
I actually don't pay a great deal of attention to taxes. You know, I take advantage of the obvious deductions when it comes to 401ks and IRAs and stuff like that. But I don't spend a great deal of time on taxes. My business is such where I don't have a lot of deductions, so I end up paying a lot of taxes at the end of the year.
Seems to me like the government has streamlined the process this year with the increase in the standard deduction anyway. So a lot of the paperwork a lot of us used to turn in on the 15th is kind of moot anyway.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to the 1099 you get for the mortgage interest you paid, unless you're paying a lot of mortgage interest because of the standard deduction, it's harder and harder to itemize deductions these days. So, you know, it actually, that was one good thing about the tax reform of 2017.
I'm glad you said that because I don't know if we're coming out ahead or not. Like it's easier, oh, that's just, there's the number, or are we getting screwed? I guess it depends on the individual, huh?
Well, the reason I said that is that we're spending less time focusing on taxes, and we're spending more time focusing on our jobs.
I got one more. This is from a listener. I've got a question for your guest. I always pay off my credit balance every month. Sometimes it gets pretty high if I'm putting large purchases on my credit card. My credit rating drops into the 700s. Once I pay the monthly balance off, the rating goes back up to almost 800. I own my home, have no other kids. Is it okay to do this?
It's okay. I mean, that's going to happen. If you have a large balance on your credit card in the middle of the month, your credit score is going to go down. And once you pay it off, it's going to go up. that's very common. You know, you could keep smaller balances on the credit card, but, you know, I wouldn't worry too much about the month-to-month fluctuations.
Especially if you're over 700. I didn't know it was that fluid, though. I didn't know that it kept that kind of track of your spending.
Yeah, it does, absolutely.
Okay, we're out of time. Lots of information there and good advice from Jared Dillian. You can visit jareddillianmoney.com for more information like this. Jared, thanks. We'll visit again.
Okay, thanks.
There he goes. It's 12:37 on WGN. Sarah Holden joins us now on the Wintrust Business Lunch. She is the Senior Director of Retirement and Investor Research at the Investment Company Institute. ICI.org is the website. Sarah, you're on WGN. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm reading a little bit about your position, what you all are saying about taxes and the pandemic. How are they different this year? Is it a consideration different in 2020-21 where we are now than in years past?
So as you well know, last year was a stressful year as COVID hit the United States. You know, the stock market fell, but then rose over the rest of the year. And many people found themselves with changing employment situations. But there's some good news in terms of tax season. The IRS has given us extra time to file our taxes this year. And if you're able to make a deductible contribution to an IRA, you could actually reduce last year's tax bill because you can count that contribution as having occurred last year up until tax day.
Even if you haven't made that contribution in 2020.
Right. So it's a feature of the tax code that when it comes to tax time and we're sorting out all of our income and what we had, we are able to make contributions to IRAs during this time and have them count as if they happened last year. And so if you make a deductible contribution to a traditional IRA, that will reduce last year's taxes. Whether or not you can do that, contributing to an IRA is just a good idea in general because you basically get a sort of tax-free investment returns. While the money is in the account, it grows and compounds as there's interest and earnings and capital gains. While the money's in the account, that keeps growing without you paying taxes. With the traditional IRA, when you get to retirement and take the money out, that's when you pay the taxes. But you've had all that great growth while it was in the account. And another way to go is with the Roth IRA. With the Roth IRA, you don't get a tax break now, so it's an after-tax contribution. But you then get to make all those great investments, whether it's in mutual funds or exchange-traded funds or individual securities, whatever you're in, grows and compounds while it's in the account. And with the Roth, because you paid the taxes up front, when you get to retirement, you take the money out tax-free.
A friend of mine says, you know, we don't maybe pay enough attention to the use of your money in retirement. That is, the order in which you actually capture it, distribution. And you're making that, I think, case very well with IRAs and Roth IRAs. When do you pay the taxes? And then what are the tax consequences maybe when your income is lower in retirement? So distribution and the plan for actually spending the money is in some ways as important as actually saving the money.
Yeah, so the decision taxpayers are making is you're trying to think about what's my tax rate now versus what's my tax rate going to be in retirement. So we find that many young savers like the Roth because they're early in their career, their tax rate is low now, and that tax break now isn't as important to them. The other thing we find is that the older IRA investors like the flexibility of the Roth because, you know, things happen, the roof needs to be fixed or the car breaks down, and having that Roth IRA gives you an account that you could take a bigger amount of money out of and have no impact on your income and your taxes in retirement.
The ability to contribute to an IRA from the previous year is not new this year. That's always been the case, correct? What is different now is that you actually have more time because they've moved the tax deadline?
Yes, that's right. So it's always the case that you have until tax day, but the IRS has given us an extension on that until May 17th. So you have more time to figure out where you want to go to open up that IRA and what kind of contribution you're eligible to make.
Any advice on where to put that money if you're putting it into an IRA?
Well, really, with the IRA, you have a world of investing available to you. If you're someone who would like some help in making those decisions, decisions. You could open an IRA at a full-service broker or through a financial advisor. If you're more of a do-it-yourself person, you could go directly online to a mutual fund company or a discount broker. But no matter how you come to open that account, you then have really at your feet all of the mutual funds and ETFs and securities out there in the market. And funds such as mutual funds and ETFs are really a great way to go for most investors, because you get a professional management of the assets. So there's a fund manager who will make all the hard decisions on what to buy and what to sell and when to buy and sell it. It will be diversified. So with that share of the mutual fund, you will be in many different companies, and it could be U.S. companies or foreign companies. It could be stocks. It could be bonds. If you're into the environment, you could look for a fund that looks at environmental issues and its investing. And so you really have a full way range of investments that are diversified within the fund. And it's cost effective. You've pooled your money in the fund and you are able to access really so much more that way.
Our guest a moment ago said that he believes in spending money on loads or fees for professional asset management. You hate to pay the nick, but if you leave it in there and amortize it over a long enough period of time, it's actually cost effective, because now you're not taking the money out. You don't want to pay to put it back into something else. And you are getting something for that charge, that fee. Do you agree with that in general?
Yeah, so really the best way to go is think of the long term. Do it little by little. So with a 401k, it's paycheck by paycheck. With an IRA, you could set up ongoing contributions. And you really want to spend time in the market rather than try to time the market. So it's really good to take the long-term view. And depending on how you access those funds, that'll depend on whether you're paying for advice or you're not, whether there's a load or there's not. And I think there's a whole range of ways for investors to access funds and the market.
Any last-minute tax advice for us now that we've turned the corner? April 15th is right there, but it doesn't matter so much this year. But any other wisdom on taxes in a post-pandemic year?
I really think the key is we've been given this extra time to sort out last year's taxes. So look into the IRA. You may be able to reduce your last year's tax bill. And even if you can't do that, an IRA can help you reduce taxes going forward because of all the great tax-free growth that happens inside the account while you're growing that nest egg to retirement.
Sarah Holden is Senior Director, Retirement and Investor Research at the Investment Company Institute, ICI.org. Sarah, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. More business news now with Dave Schwann.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Wholesale prices were up again last month. The Labor Department says energy prices were a big reason for the 1% increase. Energy prices went up nearly 6%, and we had a record jump of 1.3% in January. We're using our federal stimulus payments wisely. A report from the New York Federal Reserve shows Americans are using most of the money for paying down debt and savings. The report says on average, over 41% of people are using the money for savings, about 34% for debt payments, and about 25% for spending. Chicago-based Hyatt Hotels is announcing the opening of a new hotel in Bali. It's part of their Andaz brand, the first of its kind in Indonesia. It's located in the village of Sanur on Bali's southeast coastline. I'm Dave Schwann, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
More business news now with Steve Alexander.
Springtime in Chicago, huh, Johnny? Nothing quite like it. Have you noticed the forsythias blooming?
Yeah.
The bright yellow bushes offering that splash of color to the otherwise kind of drab landscape? I'll get to that in a minute. First, though, I've got some food news. Bloomberg is reporting the owners of Lou Malnati's are exploring options, including a sale of the pizza chain. The company could be valued at as much as $700 million, according to one of the people familiar with the matter who spoke to Bloomberg with the condition of anonymity. Shareholders, which include the Malnati family and BDT Capital Partners, are reportedly working with an advisor. The group could sell out completely or add a new shareholder or keep its existing structure in some form. That all according to Bloomberg. Now, about those bloomin' forsythias. Our gardening guru, Jim Fazell, has noticed them, and it reminded him he's got work to do.
But when I see the forsythia in bloom, it reminds me of the garden chore that really needs doing at this time. Crabgrass was a big problem last year because we had a fairly hot and dry midsummer. The turf grasses went dormant. Crabgrass did not go dormant. It proliferated, even taking over in some lawns. The way to stop that problem is to apply a pre-emergent turf grass herbicide right now. These are called crabgrass preventers and various other things. And it can be combined with fertilizer or by itself. But that will stop the seeds from germinating, not just crabgrass, but all the other pesky weeds that haven't started to grow yet. But there's a caution. If you're planning to reseed bare areas in your lawn, or if you've already done that, the pre-emergent is going to prevent it right along with the weeds. So in that case, it's probably best to put off the herbicide until later, or postpone the repairs and hope that the fertilizer and the good weather will help the grass fill in those spots. Those repairs can be made later, or the spots can actually be repaired with pieces of sod. The sod is not going to be affected by the herbicide.
Yeah, your grass may be kind of wet right now, but he says it's okay. Read the labels, but it should be okay to put it down anyway on the wet grass. Mr. Fizz says there are some things you can be planting right now, should be planting. He'll be back on Monday at this time to talk about that. From the farm to your belly today, we celebrate National Chinese Almond Cookie Day. Tomorrow's National Cinnamon Crescent Day, and Sunday's National Cheese Fondue Day. That's the business of food and crabgrass on 720 WGN.
Our last segment this afternoon is with Daniel Diaz. He is the owner of Compact Fitness. Here's an interesting thought. During the pandemic in Illinois, almost 200,000 businesses were formed. Almost 200,000 people started business during the pandemic, which is remarkable in a way, particularly since you consider that Daniel's business is a gym. Hi, Daniel. You're on WGN.
Hey, John. How are you? Thanks for having us.
Don't do that, man. It won't work.
How you doing?
I'm good. And so I don't know if you're a contrarian by nature, but I would not have guessed that that would have been a smart move at that time. But evidently it has. Tell me a little bit about your business.
Yeah. You know what? You and I think 99% of everyone I spoke to also did not think it was going to be a good idea.
Why did you decide to do it then?
You know what? It was kind of I was coaching at a location during the pandemic. So when it all happened, everything kind of shut down, and I actually built a little tiny gym in my office at home, mm-hmm. And then that was basically I think the start to us coming up with the idea that we can do something smaller and being that, I guess everybody was locked away at the time.
Yeah.
We were just hoping that once the stay at home order was lifted, that people would be eager to kind of get back into it, but also, I guess a little nervous of being in a big crowd. So we tried to create something that was going to be, I guess, the middle of both something small and private, but also something that people could get out of their houses and come to.
Well, that does seem like a sweet spot. You're in Little Village. You and your wife started it. Did you have a lot of money? I understand that you got some rent forgiveness from your landlord to start. How much did you have to invest to get going? You had to buy equipment, or did you already have some?
No. So I had been planning about a year in advance. So I had a little bit of equipment that we had bought in the process of kind of waiting out. The loan, originally I was supposed to get a loan from the bank, but once it was, obviously we're in the middle of the pandemic, so all the funds that the banks were able to give out at the time was all being used for like the COVID relief.
Right.
So then all the loan options basically got wiped off the table during that time.
Hadn't thought about that.
So we ended up just emptying the bank account and kind of crossing our fingers and hoping for the best. But yeah, Joe is my landlord. He was nice enough to give us the first 3 months for free to kind of let us see what we can get going in the spot that we opened up in.
I can imagine the happiness you felt then when customers started showing up, where they said, yeah, I'm in. I know you've got going on 100 different clients now, right?
Right. Yeah, we are at about 80 plus right now. We probably have a cap of about 110, 115, so. We're getting really close to that. It's been an amazing start. There's no way I could have predicted what was coming. It was just a shot in the dark, really.
Huh.
But it has been off to a tremendous start.
Compact Fitness. Compact Fitness is Daniel Diaz's business. He and his wife, I guess, it's the two of you that run this business, right?
Right. So my wife was in the, she does some of the background work as far as making phone calls, keeping up with memberships and stuff like that. And I do majority of the coaching. I also have two other coaches that work part-time for me. So yeah, it has been quite the start.
So it's not a gym that I just go and throw weights around myself. I make an appointment. Do I? You're my fitness trainer. You're my coach
I'm
there.
So we run small private group classes. So we have a max class size of 6 people, and it's all based off reservations. So all of our members have an app for our gym that we use, and they make their reservations through the app, and everything kind of runs through online.
Do you match the physicality of the workouts with the clients? I don't want to be in with a bunch of young studs, you know.
Right. No. So methodology behind what we do is very CrossFit-based. So it's a type of environment where everybody would basically do the same workout. It's just scaled out to your appropriate level.
Got it. Daniel, are you still got room for clients?
We do have room for clients. We always have room for clients. We have different services that we offer. So there's some clients that we have that don't come to the gym at all that we do just nutritional coaching with. We have clients that only come to the gym. We have clients that do a little bit of both. So anything somebody would be looking for, we could probably be of assistance.
Is your business model to pay a year's subscription, or do I pay as I go?
We are a month-to-month. We offer basically a pay-as-you-go. We truly believe in what it is we're offering here. So we've never felt the need to, I guess, have to have people commit to any sort of term. The people that are here, I think, enjoy being here. So it's been relatively easy to kind of keep them going.
I think that's an interesting point to make, right? A lot of us join gyms for a year that we don't go to, and the gyms know that, and they're happy to take our money, and they ain't going to let you out.
Right,
you're sort of putting your money where your gym is. If I don't like it, maybe I won't go anymore, and you don't get the money. So the onus is on you to run a good operation.
Exactly. Yeah, and I truly believe that the people, the members that we have here, amazing group of members, they see the value, and I think they understand what it is we're doing here. So for them, it's extremely easy to just keep coming back.
Daniel Diaz on the line. I got just a few seconds left, Daniel. Are you expanding? Did I read that somewhere?
Yes, sir. We are in the process of looking for our new location. So hopefully by the end of this year, we will be either making Compact number 2 or just moving Compact and making it a even bigger location.
I live in Lakeview. Open up one over there.
You know what? We'll come your way, John.
Daniel Diaz is the owner of Compact Fitness. You can find him on Instagram. I have the URL in front of me, compact-fitness.trib.com. But I suggest you Google Compact Fitness in Chicago. Look for him on Instagram. And Daniel, thanks for visiting with us today.
Yes, sir. John, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Likewise.